This is Bob Lang, oral historian with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. This interview is with Emeritus Professor Bernard Wentworth, Emeritus and Professor of Poultry Science in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. So, Bernie, to begin the interview, if you would state for the record your birth date and birthplace, and then talk a little bit about who your parents were.
I was born in 1935 in my parents' home in Freedom, Maine.
And what was the date in 1935?
Oh, February 16th.
Right in the middle of the Depression.
Yes.
Were you their first child?
No, a second.
Your second.
Then my parents, my mother had a teacher's college training.
Oh.
And was a graduate of a teacher's college.
In Maine?
Yes. It was Farmington State College, part of the now university system. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a University of Maine graduate. And in mathematics, and to this day, I don't quite understand how he came about going to college, because all indications were his parents were very poor.
Were both of your parents from Maine?
Yes. And that they were from adjoining towns. And they went to two different high schools when they were young, but the towns joined one another.
And where in Maine were those towns? Up north in Maine?
No, it's in the, probably you'd call it, I would say the south-central part.
Mm-hmm.
And actually it's not too far from the Atlantic Ocean, about 10 miles off the coast.
Oh.
It's a small town, and today a very small town. At one time, it was quite a large town. I went to a school called Freedom Academy. And before my time, they had dormitories and so forth. And sort of an old, classic high school.
And, Bernard, you grew up on a farm.
Yes.
Is that right? And how was it that were your parents raised as farmers?
Yes, they were. They were both raised as farmers, and yes, my mom's farm burned, struck by lightning, and that sort of was at the elderly time of her parents, and they never renewed. And my dad inherited the farm property from his dad, and it was a sort of a general purpose farm at that time, with orchards and a little bit of livestock and a few chickens, and just a variety of subsistence type farm.
I'm curious, Bernie, are they descended from long time Maine residents? Does the family go way back?
Not really. It's only probably one generation removed from immigration.
Uh-huh. And where did your ancestors come from?
England, mostly.
Uh-huh. So, was it a big farm? Or
no, it was a small farm, mm-hmm. as compared to what I see around here. It was rolling, not level, totally, and many stones.
So it wasn't great soil.
No, it was not.
So as you grew up, did you work on the farm?
Yes. Lots of stories about my life working on the farm. And
what did you do on the farm?
Well, we had cows, and as a very young child, my job was to feed the calves and do some of the odd things like that. And I was telling a story, one of my experiences to one of my workers here, while they hate would get put in prison for doing this today, but they put me in a barrel and left me there, and they would go to the field and pick up hay and come back to the barn, and I'd still be in the barrel.
Sort of like a playpen, sort of?
It was just a big
wow.
feed barrel. If a parent did that today, they'd be jailed.
And you'd be in a foster home.
But I could watch the barn swallows. I didn't mind it.
Wow. And did you, in view of your later career, as a child, did you do work with chickens? Did you gather eggs?
We had a small flock of chickens. And, that was, again, be one of my jobs would be to go collect the eggs, feed the chickens, and except in the wintertime when my dad did it. So the chicken house was probably 100 yards away from the house.
Uh-huh.
So snow and stuff, he usually did.
So you go to school, I assume.
Yes.
Do you have kindergarten, or do you go straight into first grade?
This I probably should talk about a bit, because it's hard to believe today. It was a two-room schoolhouse. So I had one teacher from grades 1 through 4, and a different teacher from 5 through 8.
I see.
So it was all in one room. So when I was in the fifth grade, I heard the eighth grade instruction. So I heard that 4 times. And
should I assume from that you think you were probably well-educated as a child?
In comparison to my surroundings, I think I was fortunate to have some very serious teachers.
Uh-huh.
In comparison to today, it was very substandard, because one teacher could not handle 8 classes in all the subjects.
Were there a lot of kids?
No. There was probably the two rooms, there might have been 100 students. But she would have about 50 students in a class.
Wow.
50 in a room at a time.
Yeah. Were you a pretty good student as a child? Did you like going to school?
Oh, yes. I won an award in the eighth grade. The only student that never missed a day.
Wow.
For 8 years.
That's pretty good. No snowstorms held you up or anything?
If it was, the whole school was closed, so they didn't count that.
Wow.
I enjoyed school, and I couldn't wait for summer to get over so I could go back. The nearest person my age was about 4 miles away. So I never saw anybody else my age until I went back to school, essentially.
So your best friend or playmate would be your brother, I assume?
Yes. Yeah.
Was he much older than you?
5 years.
Oh, 5 years. And what's his name?
Clayton.
Clayton. And he's still alive?
Yes. Yes. And he's single, never married.
Still in Maine?
Yep, on the farm.
Oh, the farm you grew up on?
Yeah. We switched from dairy cattle to chickens. Maybe this will come part of the story. Maine was a big broiler producer, ranked 10th in the nation at one time.
Oh.
And at that time, we built a big chicken house. It was under 200,000
wow.
broilers. And he was mainstay in there. But he still financially is not too sound. He sells off a little wood on a property every year. I actually became owner of the farm because he couldn't pay the taxes.
I see. Did you like growing up on a farm, or could you not wait to get out?
I guess I liked it. It should be, I guess a long part of this story, maybe, I don't know how to say it. I had lots of experiences going to school, talking about, and I'll get back to that in a minute. I really liked school, and I probably was a pretty fast student. And when I was about in the eighth grade, my teacher could no longer put up with me, I don't think. And I would try to pull pranks, and at that time we had inkwells and stuff. I'd put the girls' braids in front of me in the inkwell and things like that. And she used to send me to the coat room to close the door to clean it.
Oh.
And I would do that quite frequently. And I would open the window and jump out and go to the little pond behind the schoolhouse and fish.
Really?
And I didn't think she knew it until it was not probably 10 years ago. I met her one time and I went back to me. She says, I knew you did that every day. She says, I got you out of the room.
Which was the goal. Oh, that's great.
And I like baseball. My dad is a baseball player and fan. And so I played high school baseball when I was in eighth grade.
Now, I'm assuming, in view of your parents being well-educated, that there was a value placed on education.
Yes. Homework, probably a lot of my friends didn't do any. But my mother would arrange to have library sources of material that I would have to do when I got home. And the dispute between me and my dad was, I found mathematics very difficult. And he was a math teacher.
Oh, he was a teacher?
Yes. Oh, yes, he taught at Freedom Academy besides milking the cows every night and morning.
Oh.
He'd get up and milk and go teach. And then come home and after school and milk cows again. Hay in the summer. Made a good arrangement, he thought.
So math was hard for you?
Yes, and he used to make me cry. He'd make fun of me.
In class or at home?
Home.
Why would he do that?
I don't know. And that one goes along, I think, thinking I was dumb. Cause I think the part he thought I was dumb was math, probably.
That's so interesting in view of where you are now. At some point, you must
have
conquered math.
Right. I did work at it, though. You know, like, when I went to high school, we didn't have calculus. And when I went to the University of Maine, the first year, they put me in a calculus class.
And you didn't know what to do.
I found first year very, very difficult. I studied awful hard.
Bernie, before you get into high school, is there any subject in the one-room schoolhouse that you were particularly interested in? Were you scientifically inclined as a child?
Yes. Probably in biology, and particularly from the animal area. Uh-huh. I was much more interested in the animals than was the plants. Mm-hmm. But I could spend hours watching something that was the animal, whether it was a turtle or a frog or a snake. Mm-hmm. And I caused problems at times. My mother would do the washing and find snakes in my pockets.
Well, that would be a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
So, high school then is the Freedom Academy.
Uh-huh.
And is that a public or private school?
Public.
And it must have served a pretty large area?
Yes. When I was there, I guess at that time they called it large, probably six towns. Now it's 30. They built a new big mammoth.
So did you walk to school or did you ride a bus?
I rode a bus most of the time, except there was one teacher that drove by my place, and sometimes we would make arrangements. Because the bus had to go a long ways because I was a long ways for the next pickup.
Uh-huh.
And so they made arrangements that I would ride with the teacher. He was a vocational ag teacher.
So you couldn't ride to school with your father?
No, no. Well, at the time I went to school, he was no longer a teacher.
Oh, I see.
My brother had him in class.
Oh.
Somewhere between the ages of my brother, probably only about 2 years before I started high school, he stopped teaching.
I see.
And that was about the time he probably was building the chicken house.
Uh-huh. And switching the focus of the farm too. Mm-hmm. To chicken. So, were you old enough to be aware of World War II?
Very much so. You know, one of the things that brought up here just by the fourth was, my brother called me on the phone here the other day, on the fourth. And he says, "Remember what we did when kids in the fourth?" And I said, "Yeah, we used to hoe corn." And I remember one 4th of July in World War II, the planes went over all day long. There was never a time but there was a plane in sight going to Europe.
Really?
Yeah. And then there was a sub that came into Belfast, which was the nearest port town to Freedom. And the U.S. bombed it there. And we heard the explosions at my house. And
really?
We thought we were getting, Germans were bombing us.
Really?
We didn't know that we were bombing a German sub.
A German submarine surfaced in Belfast?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, they spotted it at least, and they blew it up in Belfast.
Wow.
Apparently, we believe they went in there to drop off spies. And I don't think we ever have known why it was there.
Uh-huh. But you remember it.
Oh, yes. Because my dad... I think I saw a concern on him that I had never seen before. You know, I think he would really, he was the first one that probably indicated that the Germans are bombing us.
Huh. That would be frightening. So you must then go into high school in about the late 40s?
Yes, yes.
When you're 14, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
And what are your memories of high school? Any good teachers? Any particular?
Oh, yes. I had some good teachers. I had a good biology teacher, and at that time they doubled up a lot. He was actually a vocational agriculture teacher, but he taught biology also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was probably one of his college training and strengths, and he was a good biology teacher.
Did you have lab space in the school in those days?
Yes, we did. We had a physics lab and a chemistry lab. And in fact, one of my experiences that's come up again this year, I had a commercial subject teacher that taught me how to type.
Oh.
He stopped here this summer, returning from Arizona back to Maine, 93 years old.
Wow.
Still driving.
I can't imagine.
He's retired to Arizona, but he still has property in Maine. He goes back and spends the summer in Maine. He spent a week with my wife and I here. But he was my typing teacher.
So did you take a general pre-college curriculum?
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, I took the appropriate subjects, except they weren't advanced enough. No.
So you weren't in advanced classes, you were in the regular
yeah,
classes?
Yeah, that's all we had, that's one.
I see. Any other teachers?
Yes, the one that involved with me getting in college, he was my French teacher, Mr. Cosgrove, and I used to babysit his kids while I was in high school because his wife was working as a new school nurse, I guess.
Oh.
So they leave the kids at home, which the home was sort of across the street from the high school, and I'd go over there during school hours and babysit the kids.
Uh-huh.
he was my French teacher, and he was the one that wrote my application to the University of Maine. He later became principal after he'd been French teacher for a couple of years. My town, if I went west from where I was, instead of toward the Atlantic, I went inland. It was the town of Waterville. It's a Canadian-French community. Almost all the names are French.
Is that where Bates College is?
Yes. Yeah. No, it's where Colby is.
Oh, Colby.
Yeah, Bates is down in Lewiston.
So maybe now's a good time to talk about your college plans and your what your father had to say.
Well, you know, I was committed to the farm, was happy that they had expanded in the chickens and gave us more income, you know, something, more things to do. And I was excited about this and was surprised when I got admitted to college. But once I was admitted, I was excited about going until probably I got there. I was sort of overwhelmed by the people I was around and how advanced they were in their knowledge. It seems like every class I took, they'd already had it once, so it wasn't new.
But when we met last week, you were telling me that your father was not supportive of your going to college.
No, he had, you know, I had talked with him probably when I was a senior about, I was even thinking of going to one of the, you know, sort of the two-year college. And no, you're too dumb to go to college.
And that was because of your difficulty with math?
I think that was about the only thing he had to, I think, to judge it on. Because when I get help with homework and math, I'd wait till he went to the barn to milk cows and get my mom to help me.
Was your father a strict person?
Yes, I think you'd say yes. Yes, we had chores that had to be done on time and everything. And we got up early and went to bed late. Mm-hmm. We were never wasteful, whether it was food or equipment. We serviced everything we had and make sure it was greased and oiled.
So it was your mother who helped you with math?
Yes. And she probably helped me more with homework because she probably had more time.
Mm-hmm. So I'd also like the story of exactly what Mr. Cosgrove did to help get you into college.
Well, he wrote an application for admission to the University of Maine, and he also wrote an application for a scholarship. And I guess they were actually mailed together or submitted together.
Did you know he was doing this?
No, I did not. I didn't had no knowledge that he did this. My first knowledge that this was happened when we got the letter in the mail in July saying I'd been admitted to the University of Maine with a 4-year scholarship.
How rather amazing, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
So that would have been probably around 1953, maybe?
And all been earlier than that.
Well, you graduated in 1957, so you might have gone in the fall of 52.
That doesn't sound right. 57 is when I graduated from college, wasn't it?
Right, yes.
Oh, okay.
I was just counting backwards as to when. So yeah. You would have graduated from high school in 52. And you at that point, you were planning just to work on the farm.
Yes. Yes. And I was quite happy with the setting.
Mm-hmm. And your brother was still on the farm then.
Yep.
So where is the University of Maine?
It's in Orono, Maine, and it's only, you know, at that time I thought it was a long ways away, but, you know, I drive from the farm to there now in probably 50 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Probably it's about 45 miles.
Was it, for the time, a pretty big campus? What?
Yes, yes. It was all the educational institutions in Maine that would have been by the lodges at the time. It would have been.
Did you have friends at college? Were there kids from your high school who went?
There's one was there, but, you know, I didn't ever meet up with him, I don't think, the first year at all. He was in a fraternity or something, and he became a professor at Iowa State.
Oh.
He's a plant person.
So yeah. When you went to college, before you started your first year, did you already have an interest into what you wanted to study?
Yeah, I think I did. Again, because we had built the chicken house, and I wanted to learn more about poultry.
Uh-huh.
And operation, run poultry operation, mm-hmm. so forth. And fortunately, I was assigned an advisor. He was the chair of the poultry department at the University of Maine, so he was my advisor when I arrived there.
So he was the one you worked with to pick your courses?
Right. And he also found arrangements to, you know, work and so forth. And although I had the tuition scholarship, I had to provide money for food and lodging and stuff. And
did you live in a dorm?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Pardon?
You remember the name of it, Cobbett Hall.
Really?
Yeah.
Were most of your fellow roommates and students from Maine, or?
Yes. Well, I should take that back. It would have been my second year, probably. My first year, I had a student from Boston area.
Oh.
And he was the one that probably almost convinced me to go home and not continue, because, you know, he would sleep in and never do any homework and get all A's and so forth and go out drinking and everything. He ended up flunking out freshman year. But it was not a good environment, a good role model at all.
Uh-huh.
And he come on an athletic scholarship, and but he didn't even perform well as an athlete, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but my closest friend was somebody that ended up becoming a veterinarian. We spent a lot of time together.
Now, you've made reference already to how difficult your freshman year was academically. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah. When other people were either having fun or sleeping, I was studying. My day was to stay up until at least 2 a.m. every day, every night, to study. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some things, like today I kind of chuckle about, one of the classes that I was scared to death with, and just, it was a horrible experience. It made me sick to my stomach. Speech. I had to take a course in speech.
Oh.
God, was I scared. And now I can talk to anybody. I can talk to 10,000 people.
Isn't that interesting?
The Army cut me over this. They sort of forced me into it.
I see. Was speech a required course?
Yes.
For everyone,
I suppose. Yeah.
Did you have a general curriculum? Like, were you humanities and science, or mostly science?
Mine were called an ag curriculum, I think, at the time.
Uh-huh.
But they had me on in retrospect, it would almost been a graduate student bound track. And I think, again, this was my advisor's doing. And I didn't realize that he was doing this to me. Where he was steering me was for more advanced. He was the one that eventually got me to go to graduate school. And he recommended, you know, I applied to Cornell and I can't remember where else, but they turned me down. And he says, well, the brightest young scientist out in poultry right now is at the University of Delaware. Why don't you go there? Hmm. I went there, and then he moved to Amherst and took me with him.
So
I need to say one thing about my father here before we forget it. See, I went freshman year in Maine, and in August, I was going into my sophomore year. We had a hurricane, and Maine got hit hard. He was going over a bridge when it washed out and killed him.
Oh, my.
And so, you know, here I was about ready to go back to my sophomore year. And I insisted on my mother that I stay home and take care of the chickens and work on the farm. She'd have no part of it.
Really?
She said, I'll sell the place first. She says, you go to college.
She must have had a strong belief in education and in you, I would say. Your brother did not go to college, I assume.
No.
Yep. That's quite amazing.
It's a big contrast. You know, some things he finds difficult, and like in writing and skills and like that. Mathematics, he could do anything.
Oh, your brother?
Yeah. You build a building and tell him what the angle's going to be on the rafters. He'd give it to you. No, it's just totally different.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting, isn't it, about children in a family?
Yeah.
So you did go back?
Yes.
Sophomore year?
Yes. But that time, educationally, I sort of had my feet on the ground and didn't find the coursework so difficult. In fact, I went out for the baseball team and made the team. And
what was your position?
Catcher.
Catcher.
Left-handed.
Wow.
And, you know, I traveled with them. We went to Florida in the spring. And
oh, you did?
Yeah.
You must have been a pretty good player then.
No, I was a backup catcher. In fact, I think the reason, in retrospect, why the coach kept me, he agreed that I would be the backup catcher, but I'd also have to serve sort of as manager.
Oh.
And I remember we used to stay at schools, and we couldn't afford hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd stay in dormitories and facilities at the schools we were playing at in the South. We were in Washington playing Washington University. And we were in a hotel that time. No? We were at another school's dorm. Howard? Is Howard in Washington?
Howard is in
okay.
Washington.
Okay, we were staying at Howard. Well, we'd run out of money for the team, and they had it wired to the,
Western Union.
And the coach sent me downtown to pick up the cash at the Western Union and walked from Howard downtown to the Western Union. And I come back and I had $1,000 in my pocket. And I was walking back through this black colored area, and they were hollering at me and calling me names about being white. Mm. God, I was scared.
I bet you were.
You know, here I was, you know, like a junior in college and never been in Washington before.
Mm. And probably not much experience with Afro-Americans at all.
We had one black student in the university while I was there.
Uh-huh. Well, did you get back to the team?
Yes.
Intact with your money? what's the name of your advisor who was so influential?
Robert Smith. Robert. And he comes up again in my graduate career because his son, Robert Smith Jr., was a professor at the University of Massachusetts.
Oh. Are there any other faculty in your undergraduate days that should be noted?
Yes. My part-time job was to work with a veterinarian. And I'm getting terrible names. Witta, because this has a long story, too. And I worked for him and took physiology from him. And he was a very rigorous professor. And he probably what started me off of my professional career in physiology, basically. And he was very good, but I worked for him besides having class. He would, I didn't realize until later years it was kind of a private practice. I thought he was doing this for the university. But he would spay cats and dogs and so forth.
I see.
And after I'd worked a few years, I did it.
Oh.
And he would just go about his normal business. So I was in the back lab taking care of these dogs and cats. So all throughout my career, I've been a good surgeon. And it was amazing, the number I did. And I thought this was a university. But, you know, the time I got in graduate school, I discovered this was kind of a private practice. I was working on. Although I was getting paid, I would guess out of university funds as a student. I'm not quite sure what the source would have been at the time. Because I used to have to go to the bursar's office to get the checks. Yeah. But anyway, he was, you know, again, very, very good to me. I would babysit his son the Friday night when they go out to fish fry. His son, Witter Jr., I've worked with him since. He became a professor at Michigan State.
Oh, really?
And I babysat him. I used to like to go there because he'd say, the refrigerator's yours, take whatever you want. Usually at that time I wasn't getting enough to eat. And then I joined a fraternity, and we had hazing for the fraternity. And I remember cleaning the fireplace with a toothbrush and things like this. And we were supposed to stay up for something like 48 hours with no sleep. Mm-hmm. But I had to go to the job to work for Dr. Witter. And I went down and went to work for Dr. Witter. And he put me in the ladies' room on the cot, let me sleep. And my fraternity brothers come and asked where I was. Oh, I sent him over to Porter from town across the river to pick up some samples. I was asleep in the ladies' room. So I have some good, you know, experiences with some of these professors.
Absolutely. Bernie, would you give me a thumbnail description of physiology and what it was about it that was attractive to you?
Because it's the sort of the nuts and bolts of function, why something works like it works. And once you sort of discover it in your mind that you figured this out, it always raised another question that you had to answer. And of course, this became more important in the graduate and research career. Mm-hmm. But I found this even early, like when I was working for Dr. Witter. Once I figured out, this works like this, but then how did that work? It always added one more dimension.
So that suggests to me that you're naturally curious.
Oh, yes.
And that you're not intimidated by that which you don't understand.
No.
You're attracted to it.
Right. Yeah.
And when you were working with Professor Witter, was your focus on poultry, physiology in poultry?
Yes, like we're taking the course in physiology. a section of that was on poultry, and that was the most exciting part, where I found some of the information on ruminant cattle, you know, much less interesting. You know, it seemed like I'd have to study to know the answer to that one. Uh-huh. Where some of the other ones, that was natural.
While you're in college, do you go home every summer to work on the farm?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I should go back probably. You're going to have trouble. I don't know if you'll ever fit this together or not. But when I was in high school, besides working on the farm, in this time of year until school started, I would work in a local factory canning produce.
Uh-huh.
It was a canning factory. And they canned, now the string beans and corn and so forth. And so I would work there. And I guess, I've always been a workaholic, unfortunately, because my wife of complaints about it, but I'd work a 24-hour shift, never come home.
Really, at the canning factory?
Yeah.
24
One
hours?
One of the problems was to get home, I either had to take my bike home, really convince my dad to come get me, because I wasn't driving at the time. And I had some specialties at the canning factory that they liked. Again, I've always been handy. Can fix most anything.
Uh-huh.
And there was a boxing machine that was breaking down. And they put me on this boxing machine. There was two lines. And there was a woman side of me, too. And I would work this, and they would can 24 hours a day. And they would have to have somebody there if it broke down to fix it. So they would keep me on. And this is not all good experiences, because the lady that was working inside of me was older and been there for many years, and she had a gallon of wine every day. And she used to share it with me. And this almost got me in trouble with my parents, because
sure.
I come home and my mother could smell it. Almost. Can you imagine? I was working for about 50 cents an hour.
I can't.
But I was happy to have a job. 24 hours a day for 50 cents an hour. That's pretty good.
So could you keep that money, or did you have to give some of it to your parents?
No, that was mine. But if I bought Christmas presents and so forth, it would come out of that.
So you graduate from the university in 1957. And what happens during your senior year, and how is it that you actually end up at the University of Delaware? Or no, you go to Amherst.
No, I'll go to Delaware. Probably that's not even in there, huh?
It's not on here.
Yeah. In 1958, I spent the year 1958 in Delaware.
And this is with your advisor,
yeah,
who went there.
And he moved to Amherst and brought me with him.
What was the University of... Well, let me ask you, first of all, were you pretty committed to going on to graduate school?
Yes. And, again, this is probably where I got in a disagreement with my brother and mother. Because I had... Once I graduated, I had been offered a job with... can't remember the names. It was in Pearl River, New York, a drug company. And my mother thought it was a fantastic salary. Now, why in the world would you want to spend more time in school?
Oh.
But I disagreed with her. In fact, at that time, I had no money, and I borrowed money to my brother to buy gas enough to get a car to Delaware.
Were you at all tempted by that job offer?
Yes. Yes, I was. Probably if it hadn't been sort of a city setting, I might have gone for it. I didn't feel I wanted to move into a city.
And was there also an understanding of yourself that you were perhaps a scholar, that you wanted to study more?
Yes, yes. Again, my undergraduate advisor had done a good job in brainwashing me on this.
Uh-huh.
Yes. He always, every time I come in the office or his area, before I left, he had another challenge. Either a challenge in science or education, or there was some challenge he put in front of me.
Mm-hmm. You must have been an impressive student to get that kind of attention from senior faculty. They must have seen something.
I think so, too, yeah.
So you go to Delaware, and what's that first year like at Delaware?
Okay. I arrived about July 1st, and my advisor then went on vacation. So I was left there essentially almost a month by myself and thinking I want to go home. Nobody assigned me anything to do. I didn't know anybody. And it was, well, is this what graduate school is like?
Piece of cake, huh?
But then when you come back, you know, the days weren't long enough to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
What do you assign me to do? And they were, again, challenging things. And he allowed me to challenge him.
What was he working on, and what were you working on with him?
A thyroid physiology. And this ended up being in my career, making some of the original first isolates of hormones and stuff. As a background, started out with that. I was working with thyroid physiology.
So you have 1 year there, and then he leaves for Amherst.
Yeah.
And takes you with him.
Yeah.
Did you?
I liked Amherst a lot better than Dell. I had an apartment, probably, you know, sixth-floor apartment right near the railroad tracks in Delaware, and a lot of trains went by there. And it's hot. And the only course I remember there that I found difficult, we had what we called, I'm a physiologist, but they had a course called physiological chemistry. And Delaware is a chemistry school, no doubt about it, through and through and through. And their level of expectation in that was much higher than I was used to. It was very, very advanced chemistry. So I found that difficult. I think I maybe even got a C in it.
Wow.
I know my advisor was quite upset.
With your
graduate student, you know, see.
So you get to Amherst, and you're working on your MS. And did you know you were going to go on for a PhD at that point?
No, no. See, we've skipped one part of my life that's very important too, my military life. I was an ROTC student at the University of Maine. You know,
was that required, or had that been your choice?
It was my option. But it was, you know, quite popular then, of course, at that time. And I got a little income out of it. As an ROTC student, we got a little bit of money. It wasn't much, but it was a little something.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I have a list of my nine lives why I probably shouldn't be living. You know, and that's, even as an undergraduate, is one of them. Between my junior and senior year, early June, I had to go to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, as part of the ROTC training. And we had what we call on the rifle range, where you worked in the pits, taking care of the targets, and so forth. And a bullet glanced off a bolt in the target and hit my steel helmet.
Wow.
And it shut down the firing range for the day at Fort Devens.
That was scary. You were lucky.
That was scary.
Yes, indeed.
It's amazing how you count your blessings.
And the random nature of life.
But then ROTC, and so with the ROTC, I had an obligation to serve in the military. So between my master's and PhD, they did allow me a deferral to go on active duty to get my master's. And that was very generous of the armed forces.
Was this from the Army?
Yes.
I'm assuming.
And so when I got my master's at Amherst, I thought, at that time, I met my, I shouldn't mention this, the first day I was in Amherst, July 1st, I met my wife, Alice.
And she was a chemist,
yeah.
You said.
And we went to fireworks on July 3rd together.
Huh.
We've been together ever since. This is amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So,
wish you could meet her sometime. She's a delightful person.
I'm sure she is.
She teaches every day. Teaches figure skating.
Oh, does she?
Yeah. She's my age. She gets off on the ice every day.
That's amazing. What was your master's thesis? Or didn't you have one?
Yeah. I isolated the thyroid hormone. And there's two forms of it. It's what they call T1 and T3. Has three iodines on the molecule versus two. Nobody had ever isolated the one with three on it.
Huh?
And I isolated that and purified it and showed its function and stuff.
So that was probably a pretty significant piece of work.
Yeah, in fact, I look back on it, I guess so. People kidding me about it. I gave a talk at Oklahoma, and it was at Oklahoma State University, not in Oklahoma City. And I couldn't believe it. They flew me to Oklahoma City from Amherst in a private plane from Oklahoma State, come pick me up at Oklahoma City and took me down for the talk.
Wow.
And I was just a, second year, third year graduate student. I couldn't believe it.
Well, that's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Statement. So you got your master's in 1960.
Uh-huh.
And then do you go into the
Army?
Mm-hmm. As a second lieutenant, I assume?
No, it's amazing. I went in as a first. Because I served reserve duty time while I was in graduate school, my master's, and got promoted. And unfortunately, when I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, my class was all second lieutenants except me. I was the only first lieutenant in the class. And so all the special assignments went to the first lieutenant. Colin Powell was in my class.
Really?
At Fort Sill.
Really? Did you know him?
Well, I knew him at that time. I did. He and I rode together in the back of a deuce and a half to El Paso, Texas. And I remember him sitting across the aisle from me. And we didn't have that many black officers. So I remember him quite well. I would really like to meet him today to reminisce about some of the things we did. We went there, and the Honest John rocket was the newest weaponry. We went rode in the back of a truck all the way from Fort Sill to El Paso, which is, as you realize, a long, long ways.
Yes.
Sitting on a plank in the back of a truck. And we watched him fire a rocket. We got back in the truck and rode back. That had to be one of the most wasteful, ridiculous experiences in my life. And riding with, and I think I'd like to talk with Colin about it.
Did you ever, I'm just curious, did you ever see Colin later in life?
No. No. Hmm.
Interesting. Did you, must have been comfortable in the military.
Yes, yes. I found it's compared to the people I worked with, always I seem to be a little bit ahead of them. I don't know whether this situation of first lieutenant over second all kind of progressed in my career or what. I don't know. It always seemed to be a little bit easier for me than those around me.
You said earlier in the interview that you got over your fear of speaking in the Army.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, I would, again, assigned to give classes. Again, probably, like, we'd have something that, some piece of, maybe had a calculated trajectory of a round. And I'd have to get up and give this. And since maybe I was the first lieutenant, I was the one to pick to give the class. And I just kept so I could do it. Then I've done this all my military life. Here in Madison, I was trained in, I was a educator in training officers younger than me. And I would do this, you know, once, goodness, sometimes it was once a week, but at least once a month. Then I was assigned to go somewhere in the summer, and I always was assigned to teach. They would send me to Albuquerque, New Mexico, or somewhere like that, and I'd have to teach for just. Then they would ask me to stay on, and sometimes my wife would get. I'd go for 2 weeks, and they'd ask me to stay for six. And of course, I was drawing some pay. And I'd like to stay, but my wife wanted me home with the kids.
I can understand.
But I, the military did a lot for me, and I did a lot for them, I feel. I feel I paid my tribute. Today I look at, you know, announces somebody's general over Truax, and I said, oh, I had him in class when he was a second lieutenant.
Bernie, you must have discovered then in the Army that you, even though you might have been a little nervous speaking, you must have discovered that you either had a knack for or liked teaching.
Yeah, people responded well and showed an understanding of the results of what I said. I don't know why, but I think that was true throughout, whether it was here at the university or military. My military responsibilities sometimes was overwhelming. You know, I had 1,000 troops up here to Fort McCoy one summer, and I was responsible for them. I was the commanding officer. I had 30 nurses working for me.
Wow.
You know, and that was challenging, you know, to keep everybody under control and keep the nurses happy. Some of them on, I don't want to teach this, I want to teach that. And you had me working nights, and you had me on a night problem. And, you know. But these, some of these become very good friends. I have more military friends than I have university professional friends.
Really? And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I get calls on my birthday, I get calls at Christmas, I get calls at New Year's from former service people. They may be in California or Florida or, you know, they'll call me.
So you must be a natural born leader?
If there's such a thing, maybe.
And you're glad about your military career?
Well, yes, because I feel I've served, paid some dues to my country. in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't overlook the fact that I'm getting a pension. But this was deceiving. When I joined the ROTC in Maine, I am sure they told me that once we went 20 years and retired, that the income from the retirement would be non-taxable. So that person that told me that when I was a freshman either didn't know or lied to me.
Yeah, hard to know, isn't it?
Yeah.
So when do you leave your military career to go back to Amherst for your PhD?
I had a 2-year obligation, and while I was in the military, I went, when I got a chance to visit a few schools, and I was stationed mostly at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and that's also at Fort Devens in New Jersey for a while. No, Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I would go visit schools when I'd have a day off. I'd call, so I'd visit schools and think about it. And about after the first year, I decided I wanted to go back to school. So I started looking for places to go to graduate school. And of course, my advisor in Amherst said, well, why are you looking elsewhere? Why don't you just come back here? And so I did. He let me decide what I wanted to study, what I wanted to do for research. He didn't tell me what to do or anything. I did what I wanted to do for a PhD.
Which was more thyroid work?
No. I moved on into reproductive physiology. I was convinced that some of the more frequent that there is intercourse, there's a less likelihood of fertility.
That was the thesis you just, that was your assumption?
Mm-hmm. Because I had observed this sort of with the animals, I thought, and it maybe come from my advisor a little bit. I remember him saying, you know, he says, prostitutes rarely get pregnant. And that was before the days of good contraception.
Uh-huh.
And in other words, the body gets immune to spermatozoa. And that's what I proved in my PhD. And if I inseminated a chicken frequently enough, she became immune to the semen and could no longer come fertile. So this was a contribution.
That's a huge contribution, isn't it?
Yes. But it was, he let me do what I wanted to do. He's still thyroid. That was his interest.
Mm-hmm. So again, how long did it take you to get your PhD?
I don't know, maybe say, seems like I was there for a long time, 3 years maybe. 2 years maybe.
Well, you say you got it in 1963. So
I probably started in 60.
In 60. And once you got your PhD, was it hard to get? Did you have to defend your thesis?
Yes. I had to do a pre-graduate exam, they call it an oral exam. That was probably in the end of the first year or so. Decide whether you were still capable to continue on the rest of the way for the degree. And I probably shouldn't say things like this, but I had a veterinarian on the committee. And the first question he asked me is, how much a bucket of stones weigh? You know? And it started off like that you just have to think about things. And then it got more serious into physiology. But in retrospect, about the time, I think he went to a I didn't go to the graduation exercise, but about the time I was the graduate, he says, you had the best oral defense that I've ever seen. He said, we really couldn't find anything to challenge you with. I thought that was a real compliment.
It is. It really is.
Yeah. Being a senior veterinarian, I was impressed.
Yeah, you would, once you heard that, you were really well on your way for your career. So, once you get your PhD in 1963, I assume, do you get your thesis published right away?
Yes, yes.
And that must have gotten you some recognition.
You know, I don't know. Well, yes, it did in a sense of employment. I went right on with the U.S. Department of Interior, birth control of birds, because I've, you know, figured out this reproductive situation. At that time, they were having plane crashes in Boston because they were engulfing seagulls. So they were, the federal government was trying to find a way to control the seagulls and birds. And so this is another one of my developments. It seems strange. I developed the birds have grit, you know, in their gizzard. I developed a synthetic grip out of plastic and put the human birth control compound in it. And then we put the grit, like in the smelts fish, and let the seagulls eat them. And so we got birth control of the seagulls. That grit would stay in their gizzard for 3 months. So the federal government sort of enjoyed having me. The reason I came here was they tried to move me into administration into Patuxent, Maryland. It's the headquarters of the Fish and Wildlife Service. I didn't want to be an administrator.
And so Wisconsin wins.
I started looking at something else.
So you were working for the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit.
Yeah, that was the unit.
But that was under contract with the National Wildlife?
That's right. That's part of the Department of the Interior.
Now, and you must have been doing that full time.
Yes. Well, I had assistant professor privileges under that cooperative agreement. And so I had I had three graduate students in Amherst.
Oh, really?
I completed one PhD there. Joan Stedevant. She was birth control of pigeons. She got a PhD in the birth. Used the same technique that I had, the grip. But she had to figure out new methods of getting to them. And so.
I didn't remember that the birth control, artificial birth control, was available that early.
Yes, it was. It was a compound called mestranol. It was the first, and that's another one of my trips involved. It was the first oral steroid. Usually steroids had to be injected. Mm-hmm. The company in California, Syntex, developed a conjugate of the steroid that was effective from digestion. And this compound is mestranol.
Is that the work Carl Gerassi did?
Yes. But I went to Syntex and gave some talks and so forth.
Did you know Gerassi?
You know, I think he and I was at a session together in Palo Alto. But that's just in passing. He was in the audience.
You know, he has a PhD from here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah, he studied here in the 1940s. Bernie, tell me why you didn't want to go into administration with the National Wildlife Service.
I still like the lab. You know, to this day, if I can get out and do something, I still like to do it. And that was what it was. I didn't want to get out of the lab where I could do something like this.
So, and your advisor was still at Amherst,
yes.
I'm assuming.
Yes, he and I, yeah, but yeah, my boss was in this cooperative unit, and he and I didn't totally agree. He was a little bit unethical, I think, taking advantage of federal dollars and private use of vehicles and things like this that I just didn't think was quite right. And he had a little farm, and I could see the resources of the farm as being part of our budget.
Oh yeah, that's a little shady. Bernie, as you got your master's and your PhD, was your mother pleased?
Yes. Yes. The only thing that she wasn't pleased about is I was never close enough to home.
Uh-huh.
After I moved to Wisconsin, she did come out here. She and her sister flew out here and visited. Thank goodness, I'm glad she came once. Mm-hmm. But once I went to Wisconsin, she said, I'll never see her again. When I was in Amherst, it was close enough so we could drive for Thanksgiving and stuff like this. She liked the kids.
How many children do you have?
Four.
Oh, you have four.
Two boys, two girls.
So, Bernie, we have you at Massachusetts in the Wildlife Research Unit. And you're deciding that you don't want to go on into administration. How is it that you end up at Wisconsin as opposed to another university?
At that time, there were two vacancies that I saw in poultry, and they have advertised this out of physiology. There's one at North Dakota State and University of Wisconsin. I flew to North Dakota State, and I diverted my flight after being there to come to Amherst, which I wasn't scheduled to be here. But at North Dakota State, they wanted me to work with sugar beets.
Oh.
And here I was, an animal person.
Yeah.
But the job, they were going to feed the byproducts of making sugar, the pulp, to animals. And I was to work on that. And
Not attractive.
And the school itself was not too attractive to me, you know. It seemed rather backward somewhat.
Uh-huh.
And so I diverted a flight because I had to go to Chicago, and I got a flight to stop here in Wisconsin, Madison. And I come and I talk to some people and so forth, and they said, why don't you stay another day? And I stayed another day, and they set up some interviews, and before I left, they offered me a job. But you couldn't do that today, I suppose.
Probably not. Was Wisconsin well known for poultry science?
Yes. It's probably, at that time, it was the best poultry institution in the country. Perhaps next to Cornell. But Cornell failed long before Wisconsin did. They just crashed.
So when you were getting ready to leave, did you even apply for work at Cornell?
No. I had been there several times for the Bureau of Sports Fisheries because there were some projects there that had government support that I this kind of monitoring, other means of animal control.
So, Bernie, you get, you're offered something at Wisconsin, looks like in 1969.
Yes.
Now, that was at a time of campus unrest related to the Vietnam War. Was that a problem for you?
When I got here, it was. My office is up here, what's Hiram Smith, and I was in the basement.
Oh.
And the tear gas used to drift down in there. Remember, there was a little military Quonset out here on the corner of where the microbiology is. And
yes.
And the students are always gassing, attacking that, and the authorities were using gas to disperse the crowds. And it was a sad experience. I wondered why I came. I really did. Campus. I remember I was here just a short time, and I went to a talk over in Burge Hall. As I was walking to Burge Hall, there was some GIs standing at parade rest with the opening of Burge Hall, and somebody up there on the third floor dropped the window out on him, and it crashed right behind him. Yeah. I just couldn't believe. Why did I come?
Yeah.
That my lab was over on the corner of Charter, because Hiram Smith didn't have the facilities for a physiologist. So I worked with the medical school lab.
Oh.
And even the bombing over there blew all the stuff out of my lab.
Oh, really? The Sterling Hall bombing?
Yeah, it took the windows out, knocked the reagents off the shelves, across the road.
Bernie, when you got home back to Massachusetts after you received the offer here, were you and your wife reluctant to leave the East to come out here, or happy to make the move?
It's a lot of discussions. I think overall we were happy, but it took a lot of discussion, because she was employed. She was teaching nutrition course at the University of Massachusetts. So she'd have to leave this teaching position. Plus the fact she was pregnant. And I talked Wisconsin into delaying my arrival until after my wife gave birth to the last child.
Oh, so you had three children by this time.
Yeah, and the fourth one's on the way. And so I arrived here right after my youngest daughter was born.
And so you begin work in the fall of 69?
Yes, I finished the semester of teaching a course in physiology that the previous professor had left to take a job in California.
And tell me what that course was again.
Called avian physiology, the bird physiology.
Mm-hmm. When you came, Bernie, what were the expectations of you for research as well as for teaching?
Yeah, I had a three-way appointment. And I had about, it was third. I had a third of my salary was being paid for research, a third for teaching, and a third for extension. I had an extension appointment, too.
Oh, you did. So the expectation was you would be doing a lot of work out in the state.
Mm-hmm. This was an enjoyable experience, too. I didn't know the state very well. The people of Wisconsin were my main accent and so forth. I just didn't fit in very well. I remember stopping in tavern up in Eau Claire. I hadn't been here too long. I went up on to visit some farms. It was going to be a couple of days, so I stayed overnight, and I went, people of Wisconsin with my main accent and so forth. I just didn't fit in very well. I remember stopping in a tavern up in Eau Claire. I hadn't been here too long. I went up on to visit some farms. It was going to be a couple of days, so I stayed overnight, and I went to a tavern, and a couple of people sat there. I kind of sat aside, but they got up and moved. They didn't leave the bar, but they just moved. And I just started to make some small talk to them about the weather. I said, whoops.
This is an alien. Do you come here with tenure? Or?
Yes. Yes.
So you didn't have to deal with any of that. Can you talk about who the other faculty were at that time? In your associate professor, 69 through 73, four years. Who was head of the department, and who were the other key faculty?
The head of the department when I was hired was a Dr. Herb Bird, who was deceased, but a very worldly, notable poultry nutritionist. Then there's Dr. Sunday, which I think you've met.
I've met him.
And he was also a nutritionist. However, when I arrived, I think he was on a sabbatical in Brazil, maybe. I think it was in Brazil. Then a guy that I probably was as close to, Lou Arrington was here. And I think you're going to meet with Lou.
I am.
He was a brand new, he hadn't been here very long when I arrived.
Mm-hmm.
An extension. And Skinner, which I think you're going to talk with, was here in extension.
Mm-hmm.
But the one I probably, he was the one that probably convinced the department to hire me when I stopped in on the spot, was a Henry McGibbon, a geneticist.
Hmm.
He has to be one of my most unforgettable characters. He was the most observant individual I've ever met. He could see things that nobody else could see.
In people or research or both?
Both. 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 Like he could look at a flock of 1,000 chickens and point, there's a sick hen over there. They all look the same to me.
Hmm.
And I travel with him. And he sees things side the road. Wouldn't even know they were there.
This is McGibbon?
Yeah. Unfortunately, he died a little prematurely with pancreatic cancer.
Oh, sorry. But while he was alive, were you and he colleagues? Did you do much work together?
Yes, yes. You know, he was probably closer to physiology than all those nutritionists were. And he probably got me into where I ended up my career in physiology, more advanced in DNA work and stuff. He understood that at that time, which is really kind of really premature.
Bernie, when you came here, were you doing any more work on intercourse between chickens and what you had done your thesis on?
Yes. I had a bunch of undergraduate students that wanted a project, and I set up a project, the pigeon control, and rather elaborate. I got funding for it, and I had three cities. I had Janesville, Beloit, and Madison, and we set up some birth control of pigeons, and the students were thrilled about it. You know, we were recording the number of young that they were raising in the various nests and so forth. And
it's okay.
That was.
So you were talking about pigeon control with your undergraduates.
And the project was going very, very well until we discovered that they were trapping the pigeons in Beloit and eating them after we'd given them birth control compounds. So that ended that. So I never did do any more of my PhD work anyway. That ended it.
I would guess so. So when you come here, are you told that you can pursue whatever research you want to?
No, I had a responsibility to be the overall control of turkeys. So I was given, turkeys are your bird. So I was given a flock of turkeys. You know, when I arrived in November and had to hatch them the next spring, and we had the farm in Arlington, and goodness, I had as many as 5,000 turkeys out there.
Was that okay with you?
Yeah, because I did reproductive physiology of turkeys. That was probably my biggest contribution to the industry. They were having trouble commercially getting fertile eggs from turkeys. And we discovered through my research at Arlington that all we had to do was inseminate those turkeys shallow, just get a drop of semen in the edge of the vagina, and they were very, very fertile. They were using straws about 3 inches long and shoving them in as far as they could. They were going right through the wall of the vagina. Industry was big mistake. And I had to demonstrate this with, you know, a lot of section men and histology and so forth. And the results that I could show, we went up to 90%, 92% fertility. When I arrived here, the industry was getting 70%.
Bernie, had you done any work with turkeys before?
One of my colleagues, he wasn't my professor, but we all did joint work in the department there in Amherst. You know, Bob Smith, the son of the professor in Maine,
yeah.
He was a turkey man at Amherst. So he used to ask when they needed an extra help. Well, that when I arrived in July, I think it was about July 2nd, he had to weigh turkeys. He took me out there to weigh turkeys. And at that time, I weighed 108 pounds. I was so tired when it came night. We worked long days. I thought they were going to fly away with me. I would grab one. I don't know whether he was testing me to see how I'd stand up or what. But that was a hard day's work.
Yeah.
But I used to help him. That wasn't my major project. But if they needed an extra hand or turkeys, I helped. So I did know the bird. Respected him.
Excuse my ignorance. Is it easy to move from species to species, like from different kinds of chicken to pigeons to turkeys?
Yes, yes. Their basic underlying physiology is very comparable. Few little wrinkles and deviations along the way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was the turkey industry, when you came here to Wisconsin, a big one, or was it?
Yes. We were probably, I would guess, at that time, the third producing state in the country.
Really?
Wisconsin, Minnesota, California.
And so you probably got to know the industry leaders.
Very. That's what I was, you know, go to Eau Claire and up to Barron. And the headquarters of the turkey operation was in Barron.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very notable individual up there. And
and how long did you stay with turkeys?
Until the department closed it. The department made the decision that there would be no more turkeys. So that was probably in 2005.
Yeah, we'll, at a later point in the interview, I want to get into the life of the department and decisions that the department made, so we will remember that. So you come here. What else are you teaching in that before you become a full professor in the period of 69 to 73?
I taught the avian physiology. And I also was assigned to teach a course in poultry management. And it was somebody else had been teaching it before I was hired. And I guess he didn't make tenure. So I picked up his course.
And what is that when you say poultry management?
Oh, this was the bottom line, the dollars. What do you do? Do you buy on bid? Do you hedge? Do you hope for the best and just shop around for an open market? Do you contract?
I see. Did you enjoy teaching that? I didn't think so, by the way you were describing it.
In fact, since we'll talk about the most recent ventures in poultry, what they call the Poultry Consortium, when that developed, I had that also there, and I found it very difficult. I had a colleague that was brilliant in that area. In fact, he used to save my day. Still living. Bob Looning, agriculture economist. He's in an assisted living out here.
Okay. And are you starting with graduate students in your first 4 years here?
I was given one. The professor left. I inherited another student, another professor's student when I come.
And did you like working with graduate students?
Yes. In fact, he's in the list of one of the, I just couldn't believe it. Another colleague told me just yesterday that he's thinking of retiring. I said, well, he can't retire. And then he told me, well, he's 67. And he was my first graduate student here at Wisconsin. But he was a Vietnam veteran. And so forth. But now he's a famous worldwide poultry. He knows, he's the most knowledgeable person in the world on how to get a chicken to hatch.
Really?
No doubt about it.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's looked at, he come back here and taught for a week this summer.
What's his name?
Mike Wineland.
Okay, we'll get to him again when we go through all your graduate students.
But, you know, like when he was here, he says, I'm leaving here, I'm going to Moscow, then I have to go to Australia. And he says, then, you know, he says, I'm going back to Vietnam. He says, I'll be interested to see what Hanoi looks like since I left.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
Amazing.
Now it makes me realize why he's 67. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Let's see. So it's in 1980 that you become a full professor?
That sounds right. No, it should be earlier than that. I made full professor in, well, maybe 73 or so.
Well, you're listed as an associate professor 1969 to 1973.
I think I made full professor in 73.
Oh, here it is. Professor Poultry Science and Animal Sciences, 1973 to 2005. How did your life change when you became a full professor? Did you have other things to teach or...
No. I think I got many more university assignments.
Yes.
Committees. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, we'll want to talk about your university service at a later point.
Yeah.
Maybe the thing to do at this point...
I have more graduate students. Maybe it was easier to get money. Yeah.
Bernie, if you're willing, could we go through your full research program at this point? You know, you've started with Turkey here, and maybe you could then talk about, well, we have this section in your resume, some major scientific contributions in research and development. Maybe you could talk about that and the significance of those.
Well, that list of things?
Yes.
And we talked about the first one already. I was the first to isolate the second thyroid hormone.
Right.
And originally, after that time, worldwide, we thought there was one.
And the significance of that?
They have different activity. The one with the three iodines on it is much more potent. And it's been very important to the medical profession to know the distinction. It, some people secrete more of one than the other in their normal life, and it helps in the treatment and diagnostics of which one is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the second one is benefit. Oh, the second one I got down here really was after that, really, because it was in my PhD program, was showing that frequent mating caused infertility.
Right.
And then, okay, this involved the turkey industry. We tried to figure out what was causing the hens to ovulate or lay an egg. And we knew that in mammals at that point that there was a hormone produced called LH, luteinizing hormone, and it had been purified by a good chemist over here in zoology, which is over here off Johnson Street. What's the name of the... It was a lab for zoology, not birds. Nolan, is it? They tear it down? I bet they torn it down, haven't they?
I don't know.
On the corner of Chatter and Johnson. But anyway, that's an interesting story in itself. The guy, I think, was a Nobel-type person and never got the notoriety. He isolated hormones. You know, I should tell this story. I don't know whether I'll get it on the record or not, but...
Yeah, let's get it on record. What was his name?
Well, I'll recover that, get that to you. His postdoc's name was... Anyway, what he did, and I'll get the name. He was the first to discover the compound. You hear the comment about pheromones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an everyday language today.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what it was before he discovered it. And what he did was to put a bunch of flies, and they were moths, really, in a cage. Then he made a grid with cheesecloth and put tallow on the cheesecloth, fat, and moved the air through that screen and collected those pheromones in the tallow. And then he chemically isolated this compound out of the tallow. I think this was Nobel Prize work. And Nutting was his name.
Nodding?
Yeah. Yeah. And he also, his post was the first to isolate LH, luteinizer hormone of mammals. And they isolated it from a cow's ovary, a cow's pituitary, that's what it was. And he would go to the slaughterhouse and get several buckets full of pituitaries from the slaughterhouse to isolate this hormone. Huh. And he had to isolate the hormone, and we had applied this to turkeys, no response, nothing. So therefore, the turkey has a different one. So we were first to isolate a chemical variant of the previous LH that was specific for turkeys. So we were the first to do that here.
Wow.
And one of my graduate students was heavily involved with that. So that was good. That's a LH line in there. The development of long-lasting... Oh, I talked about the synthetic grit.
Yes, you did.
And that, if it's in sequence, it would have been earlier, back when I was in Amherst.
Right.
But at that time, it was very important. I don't think... I did discover that is in, I guess, Italy. They're still using this.
Oh, are they?
Bird control.
Huh.
Now, this guy that worked with over here in zoology, he became my postdoc, Gremmick. He was the one that makes the first highly purified FSH. Okay, there's one hormone that causes the animal to ovulate. There's another hormone that causes the ovary to grow, or the testes to grow. And that compound is follicle-stimulating hormone.
Uh-huh.
Got a name for the ovarian follicle.
Uh-huh.
Gremmick was the first to isolate a purified FSH. And he came from that same zoology lab.
Oh.
And after his professor retired, he came over and worked with me.
He was in Nodding?
Yeah.
Lab?
Okay. Well, then the next one is that shallow insemination of turkeys.
Uh-huh.
That was a mechanical error of the industry. But we had to show them. You'd be surprised how hard it was to convince them presenting this orally at meetings. They wouldn't want to, believe it.
Why?
You know, finally I went around and called mating of birds as a cloacal kiss. And finally, that term got sort of ingrained in the into the behind-the-scenes talks that they finally begun to believe it. If you look at birds naturally, that's how they mate. You know, there's no penetration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the birds are set up to be very fertile. And but we had to prove this to the industry because they didn't want to believe it. I think I give them more talks on that than anything else.
Oh, really?
Then the one more recent, about the end of the time I had the turkeys up there, just trying to cut down the cost of managing and maybe if you could say come more green. We started feeding the turkey silage and discovered they liked it. If we mix the compound, a mixture of alfalfa and soybeans and corn and put it in a silo, they loved it. And we're still getting some out of Canada. I'm still getting correspondence that they're working on this. But it's not, the management of it is more complex. You had to have the silo. You had to have the device to unload it. And it had a keeping life on it. See, it was moist. It doesn't store like dry grain. So its popularity had never caught on. It works, but it's not as good as dry grain. I'll admit that.
There are environmental reasons for it?
Oh, it's a renewable resource. You know, this is the whole thing. And we could get everything that Turkey needed essentially off the fields. Let the plants collect the calcium and phosphorus and nutrients, and vitamins. We did have to add some vitamins to this.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So it's the silage program is not used much today?
No, a little bit in Canada. Mm-hmm. Maybe some other parts of the world. But it will work. Must be just about it. Oh, this is the work that my wife and I ended up on with demonstrating that one of the problems with turkeys, unlike chickens, you know, like I got quail now downstairs. They will lay an egg a day. We've had them lay 300 eggs in a year. They don't stop laying. Turkeys lay a clutch of eggs. They lay a group of eggs and stop. And the hen that we use for table eggs will lay and lay and lay every day almost. It might, you know, skip one a week, six eggs a week, something like that. Now turkeys lay this clutch of eggs and they want to sit on it and incubate them. And this hormone that causes them to change from laying to incubating is prolactin. So my group here in the lab, we were working to develop the DNA sequence for an antisense gene that would block prolactin.
Oh.
So that's, and we were successful in doing it, and we were transferring this gene to embryos so that this embryo would grow up having the gene in place so it would not go broody or incubate eggs. But we couldn't get this gene to stick over one generation. It would have it. I think now if we were to do it over, we have enough new knowledge of DNA technology so that we probably could get it to stick. And I have a colleague that worked with us on this from VPI, Virginia Polytech. He's still working on this at Virginia Polytech.
Hmm. Are you doing any turkey work anymore?
After they got rid of the flock, that was it. If you look me up on the website, I'll come up immediately being the authority of the midget turkey.
And what is that?
It's a small turkey. It only grows to be about 10 pounds. It's a beautiful little bird. If you dress it off and eat it, it's the most impressive Thanksgiving meal you'd ever want to have put in front of you. And like a retired couple, if they eat alone Thanksgiving, they would love it. It's not very economical. It grows slowly. But this professor at Amherst, Bob Smith, Jr., he and I developed it.
What prompted you to develop that?
Well, at that time we thought it would be good. We thought it would be a small market version of the turkey. And it's what we would get today if you went to the market and bought a pre-cooked broiler chicken, you know. Mm-hmm. About that size. That's what it would have been. But that's what we had in mind. But it's turned out to be an icon for people liking it. A pet.
A pet?
Yeah, they have it around. If you have a small farmette, you want a pair of midgets. I have a former graduate student from Ohio State, and she gave it to her grandparents. And I had an email from her a while back. She says, you know those midgets are still alive? and they act like guardians. And we drive in the driveway, they carry on and scold as if you're not supposed to be there. But you look me up if you want to look it up on the website. That's all you'll find about me. It's Mitchell Turkeys.
Are those available commercially if you want to?
You know, that's amazing. I get correspondence all around of people wanting them, and we haven't had a hard job to find a source. There's a guy out here in Sun Prairie, apparently is one of the sources. He still has them. Supposedly, they have some still in Ames, Iowa. But they have mismanaged them and allowed them to breed with other birds. So the pure line of midget apparently is becoming very questionable.
I see. Are they particularly good to eat?
Oh, they taste just as good as they. They're probably appealing on the platter or more appealing than any other turkey you've ever seen.
Interesting. I've never heard of that. Now I have something new to tell my wife.
If you look up Bob Smith and I, that's about all you'll find on the web is the midget turkeys. We've become very popular in the midget turkey. What am I on now?
Their work. Bernie, I want to ask you to turn your focus now from your research program to the graduate students that you've had, particularly your PhD students, what they worked on, where they are, and what's significant about their work.
The first ones that I see on the list are postdocs. Is it okay to cover that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Okay, one of the earlier postdocs I had was an individual, Dr. William Burke. And at that time, he was at the University of Minnesota, and he came to here and worked in the lab with me on turkeys as a postdoc. And then he actually went back and served in the professorial staff at the University of Minnesota in that turkey program. And then he moved and became the chief turkey fit program, I guess you would say physiologist again, at the University of Georgia.
Oh.
And he is now retired, but he made a reasonable contribution, I feel, in turkey physiology, again, and probably reproductive management. He may have worked more in the frequency of laying rather than just plain fertility.
Okay.
And but he retired, I would consider, maybe too early. You know, it seemed like that he didn't really fill out his career well. I think the opportunity for retirement arose and he just elected to retire.
Georgia has a good poultry program, doesn't it? Or it did.
Yeah, and they still do. And another one I have is Dr. John Proudman, and he sort of tracks behind me. His advisor, as a doctoral student, was in thyroid physiology under my private professor in Amherst.
Oh.
So he came here to me as a postdoc, knowing that he was going to have to work in reproductive physiology. And he accepted that very well. And he was the first, I should probably have it on the list. I didn't take credit for it. He did. He's the first to isolate growth hormone from birds.
Oh.
He's got it. Oh, out of that midget turkey. He isolated growth hormone from midget turkey.
Oh, did he?
And he found that different breeds of turkeys have different levels of growth hormone. And that's probably why they grow. He found it very slow in the midget. And like I said, it takes them forever to grow up as compared to the others. But he went on and became the head physiologist of the USDA in Bellsville, Maryland.
Oh.
And he's now retired, but he moved up through to be the senior scientist in the group of at the USDA lab in physiology. Very, very notable person, and made great contributions to the industry. And this other one is Lou Nudy. He was another one for the McShann era over here in zoology. And he got his PhD with McShann. And he came here as a postdoc, and he worked with me in doing assays of hormones, we were trying to determine whether good laying birds or good reproductive birds had different levels of sex hormone, which he showed they did. But I think his major contribution was working with a professor over here in vet science, working with cattle and showing the same thing was true with them. So he sort of, although I was paying him as a postdoc, he was working with both of us, which was good. Herb Gremick, I mentioned, he was the first to isolate the highly purified LH and then the FSH. And he did a lot of this hormone isolation while he was working here as a postdoc. It's interesting in time. You know, when he started working with hormone isolation, we required, you know, 5 kilos of pituitary. By the time Gremick left here, he could isolate the hormone from a gram.
Wow.
The technology had changed this much. Dr. Marie's story, this is one I have not tracked, unfortunately. I have a little bit of information on it. She left here and went to somewhere. She's director of Center for Food and Nutrition Policy in Washington, D.C. That's the last track I've had on her. I don't know what she was doing. She was more of a nutritionist. And I think we probably don't want to get involved with this. It was a situation of some harassment along the way, and the university assigned her to me to continue payroll for a while. And she definitely wasn't in physiology. Mm-hmm. She was somebody that was a nutritionist, really. Now we have the graduate students. Want the graduate students?
Yeah.
They're here somewhere, aren't they?
I think so. Okay, now switching to the graduate students.
And then these should all be the University of Wisconsin ones, right?
Correct.
Okay. One of them is Glenn Barancourt. He's currently a professor at Clemson and still working with poultry. And I think he has a major responsibility at the Department of probably Animal Sciences of teaching the major physiology course. And when he was here as a student, I first knew him as a senior working in the lab.
Oh.
And when he became a graduate student, I know one of the key professors over here in animal science, a very noted reproductive person in the science of animal science, Cassiter, they had a seminar here honoring him this spring. He's deceased for probably 10, 15 years now. Said that Glenn Barancourt was the most brilliant student he'd ever met.
Really?
Yeah. And he hasn't performed well.
No?
As a professional.
Why do you think that is?
I don't. I guess I could have some theories about it, you know, get it on record. He had a love affair when he was here. Very serious. He was devoting his whole life about it. And all of a sudden, she just found somebody else and said goodbye. In my mind, he's never been the same since. He lost some drive and life enthusiasm. I don't know.
The intersection of personal and professional.
I guess this can happen. Probably.
Yes, I think so.
And the second one I have on the list is Magdi Mashali, an Egyptian student. He came here unfunded from foreign country or anything. I picked him up on his credentials. He looked good. Good worker. Did a good job. He had an assigned project, another hormone with Turkey, progesterone. And progesterone is one involved with egg formation again. He did a good job on this. He became a professor at Penn State University. And I understand now he has a very high administrative assignment back in Egypt.
No.
He's gone back to Egypt. So he's no longer at Penn State. Mike Wineland, we talked about him earlier. He was the Vietnam veteran. Worked with female sex hormones of turkeys. And not only that, and we'll talk about him in a department later on, he became the manager overall of the farm poultry operation. He dual purpose as a graduate student, and he became the overall university farm manager. And I think that gave him experience to put him where he is today. He's being such an outstanding individual. He could think and plan ahead.
Wow.
So that's not all my contribution as far as Nick Zimmerman, another good poultry physiologist, the best animal surgeon I ever met, better than any veterinarian that I've ever met. At one time, he had in addition to being a graduate student, he worked over at the medical school to do surgery on rat livers. He could anastomose an artery in a rat liver surgically. But he could put a cannula in a turkey's carotid, he'd never see a drop of blood.
Wow. Really skilled.
He had the best hands. You know. And he's one, you know, and count our blessings that he's alive. I went to a meeting in Vancouver, and it was a very prestigious reproductive physiology meeting. And lo and behold, he and his wife showed up, and I knew he'd had a brain tumor and had surgery. And she brought him, and she led him around and took the first seat in the stands. And I thought, my gosh, this is so sad. He was having a hard job recognizing me.
Oh, really?
And I thought, this is so, so sad. And this brain tumor and surgery. He's now a full professor at the University of Maryland.
Really?
Yeah. Noted scientist there, doing good work.
Amazing.
And I respect him so much, and his wife, Mary. She just helped him so much. You know, most people would have given up on it. But it's amazing that you can recover like this. And it's obvious he knows, because I get an email from him asking about an experiment he and I did with cranes. He'll ask me, wants details on it. He knows more about it than I do. And that was back in 1971.
Wow.
Okay, the last one is Jeff Mallison. It's one that I sort of picked up here in the department. He was undergraduate here. And he became very interested in fish aquaculture, the reproductive of fish. And he's retired. But he's built, they tell me, $1 million home up here in Monaco. But he found that he could sex reverse fish. Female fish grow faster than males.
Oh.
So if you have a bunch of eggs, fish eggs, you can treat those eggs so that they all hatch as females.
Really?
And so in the culture of fish, I didn't have, I was involved with it, but I'll have to admit, it was his project. All I did was sort of advise him along the way and make sure you do your statistics and verify such and such and helped him with the writing and things like that. But he was he became a professor here in the department.
Oh, did he?
Professor of aquaculture. When he retired, he left the department.
Hmm.
He just left last year.
Amazing.
So that's the last one I had on the list. Oh, no, I got some more. This other one's a bonnet. Afa Nasser. She was one that I inherited from Masterson, Nebraska. And her advisor called me and said, I have this student that's finishing. I think she's capable of doing a PhD. Would you be willing to consider her? She's funded by Kuwait. And I said, well, let me interview her. We're having a meeting, a pork science meeting nationally. So I met her there and interviewed her. Yeah, good English, up and coming, looking young lady and so forth. Why not? Government's funding her. She wanted to do heat stress physiology because she wanted to raise chickens in Kuwait in the high temperatures. So she did her whole PhD project down here in the Biotron, basically. Also about 108 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And it was a difficult... I'm sure you're going to edit this out, but I think you'll be interested. A difficult individual to manage. She had money. And she arrived, and I had my technician take her around to look at a department. And next day, no, couldn't find one. That's good enough. And she actually said that. Then she finally rented one of the most expensive departments in Madison. And the next day, she decided she needed a car. So again, my technician took her to the car dealers around, and I looked at the car. And the next day, she came in with a brand new Ford. But things like this made it really hard to fit in with the rest of the graduate students. At that time, I had 7 graduate students. And a lot of them were living from, day to day to have enough to pay the apartment and have some food.
Yeah.
And then she comes in and... but she wasn't arrogant about it. If she had something extra, she shared it. In fact, at the Biotron, the help down there never told me. But when she left here, they said she gave us a substantial amount of money. And I didn't ask any more questions.
Mm-hmm.
But, can you imagine this?
I can't, really.
They were just, laborers down there.
What was the quality of her work?
Oh, good. Excellent. I would put it excellent. I just got something, a brochure come across. She is the incoming president of the World Poultry Science Association to meet in Turkey.
Huh. Wow.
And so I got her email address off that announcement, which I'd kind of lost track of her. So I sent her an email and congratulated her. And she says, things are going well in Kuwait. She says, I'm getting new money. She says, we're going to get some thermal cool environment, and we're going to start having ducks instead of, as well as chickens. So she's still working. See, the last address I had from her in Kuwait, she's the director of the Institute of Animal Research, University of Kuwait. So she just moved up.
Been very successful.
Yeah. And the last one is a girl that I picked up from, you know, recruiting students, and she was with me an awful long time. Hung Tsai, girl from Taiwan. Probably next to this Herb Grammett, the most rigorous scientist I ever had. She would have to do something 10 times to make sure that what she found was right. You know, which is unusual. I kind of recommend 2 or 3 times. 3 times, you know. It made her progress really slow. But boy, if you wanted to learn how to do something right, you asked her how to do it. The last I know, she's in working in forensic technology at the state of Florida. She's in the state forensic lab.
Oh.
Single girl. I'm a little bit concerned because the last couple of emails, I've got no response for her. They didn't bounce back. I'm just a little bit concerned. I don't know.
So I take it you stay in pretty regular contact with your graduate students and postdocs?
Yeah.
And do you see most of them at national meetings?
Yes. Even the foreign ones will come. AFA, NASA, you know, she would come. She had money to come. 2 years ago, she showed up at my house door. AFA, what are you doing here? I'm looking for a house. I said, what? Yeah, I'm going to buy a house. It was about this time of year. She says, we have holidays in Kuwait. For 3 months, we don't work. And says that everybody goes on summer vacation. I said, really? Well, she ended up buying a house in Michigan because she has a friend that lives in Michigan.
Oh.
So she bought a house near them. But she spent a couple days around Madison, wanting to know who the best realtor to deal with. And she looked at houses around Madison for a couple of days. She wanted a summer home.
When
she was here during the Kuwait crisis, she was here during that time. I said, well, aren't you concerned about your parents? They'll be okay, but I wonder about my cat. The parents be okay.
You've met a lot of interesting people.
Oh. Life, yeah. Keeps you young.
Oh, really does. Is that it for the graduate students?
Yeah, Tsai, I wish I could give her more credit because I guess that fits being so rigorous. A forensic lab would be a good place for her, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you really have to be sure of your evidence.
Yeah. So, you know, so she's done all right, and I would guess ethically she was probably the most rigorous of all. She would never, never violate anything.
Well, that's a real compliment.
You know,
include this. This now concludes the first portion of the oral history interview with Professor Emeritus Professor Wentworth on July 23rd, 2013.